From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, cockfighting, the blood sport in which chickens fight it out while people watch and bet. Journalist Burkhard Bilger traveled to some of the places where the sport is still legal and reports on cockfighting in the current edition of Harper's. The article will be part of a book he's writing on clandestine Southern traditions. Also, we meet comedy writer John Max. He writes for The Tonight Show and has written for Billy Crystal when he's hosted the Academy Awards. Max is currently writing for this month's Academy Award show. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new CD by the Black Crowes. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Cockfighting is a blood sport in which chickens fight it out while people make bets. Because it's illegal in many places and frowned upon even in some places where it is legal, the culture around it is somewhat secretive. My guest, Burkhard Bilger, has written a fascinating article about cockfighting, what the sport is like today, its history, and what it says about our culture. It's published in the current edition of Harper's. Bilger has also written for The Atlantic Monthly and The New York Times. He's a contributing editor of Health and deputy editor of The Sciences. I asked him why he wanted to explore the world of cockfighting.
Well, I was interested in kind of clandestine Southern traditions because I'd grown up in Oklahoma. My parents were academics. I kind of lived in a standard American suburb and didn't have much connection to local culture, really. It was just kind of a sitcom existence in some ways. And at one point, I was looking through some strange magazines. One of them was called Feathered Warrior, which ended up being a national cockfighting magazine, and kind of discovered that there was it wasn't just a strange little subculture that had been outlawed long ago, but was a real vibrant thing. There were thousands of people doing it, even hundreds of thousands. There were 500,000 of them, some people think. And just wanted to explore that and kind of get a sense of the life that I'd missed growing up in Oklahoma.
Is there a lot of cockfighting in Oklahoma?
Yeah, there is. Definitely two of the biggest pits in America are there. One's called Mid-America. It's on the Arkansas border, and one's called Texoma on the Texas border. And Texoma's huge. It's this enormous amphitheater, and they gave $150,000 to the biggest winner last year and a truck to the cock of the year. So it's a huge, huge thing there.
Now, I've never seen a cockfight, and I imagine a lot of our listeners haven't seen one either. So why don't we get to a description of what a typical cockfight is like, if there is such a thing as a typical cockfight. Perhaps you can describe one of the cockfights you saw at the Red Rooster in Louisiana.
Well, the Red Rooster is a rickety little building in the middle of nowhere next to Maurice, Louisiana. It doesn't look like anything from the outside. There's barely even a sign. You go inside, and it's kind of all plywood, and everything's not square, and there's a little concession stand. And you walk in, and you see kind of this miniature Thunderdome. It's this amphitheater of seats, kind of rickety benches. And the middle is this enormous two-story octagonal cage, which is made out of chicken wire. And it's elevated off the ground, and it's completely enclosed. And that's for a certain kind of Cuban cockfight where they just put the chickens in and leave, and they consider it the most natural cockfighting. But anyway, it's enclosed mainly to protect the spectators from the birds, which are wearing these knives on their heels in most cases. So the two handlers come in, and there's a referee in the middle who's wearing black and white stripes. And the handlers have to hold their chickens very tight in their arms because they're already pumped up. A lot of them get testosterone injections or digitalis to make their hearts race or any number of things to get them up for the game fight. And so they're really raging to go at each other. And the two handlers will stand side by side and kind of sway toward each other and let their chickens peck at each other for a while and get their dander up, so to speak. And then they'll put them behind two lines that are a few feet apart made out of cornmeal that are laid in the sandy floor of this cage. The referee stands in the middle and he'll say, pit. And then the handlers will let their chickens go. Up until then, it's all pretty straightforward and even paced. But as soon as they go, I mean, the chickens move at 1,000 times the pace of everybody else in the room. I mean, it's like warp speed compared to everything. And all you see is this huge flurry of feathers and slashing talons. And for a newcomer like I was the first time I saw one, it's almost impossible to see what's going on. But the people who really know what's going on and have kind of accustomed their eyes to it can see, you know, what's happening is that the roosters are jumping up and dipping their tails down toward the ground and then spinning their talons with these knives that are attached to the back of their heels down in a kind of a windmill pattern at each other. And if they're lucky, one of them will strike, you know, in the head or the eye or in the neck, and then they'll fall down again and the whole thing starts over again.
Now, what are the rules of cockfighting compared, say, to the rules of boxing?
In some ways they're the same. You know, they're rounds. Every time two chickens get tangled up, if their spurs or their gaffs get tangled in each other, they separate them, and the referee comes in there and puts them apart. And in some places, like in Bali, they'll drop a a coconut, a pierced coconut, into a tub of water, and the time it takes for that coconut to sink to the ground, the chickens get to recuperate. And just like handlers in a boxing match, the cockfight handlers will take the chicken and talk to him and rub him and wash him off. And sometimes they'll stick his whole head in their mouth and suck the blood out, or even spit into his beak to give him some refreshment. So in some ways, it looks like a boxing match. What's different is that a boxing match obviously has rules of sportsmanship. You know, you can't do rabbit punches and so forth. But a cockfight, there isn't any. It's once they're in the pit and they're going, it's no holds barred.
Do they fight to the death?
Yeah, they always fight. I mean, they don't necessarily fight to the death. If a chicken dies and the other one is won. But essentially, they fight until one of the chickens dies or one of them runs away or refuses to fight anymore.
Now, are there ways of playing dirty within cockfighting? I mean, you've told us what the basic rules are. Are there...
Oh, there are innumerable ways to play dirty. I mean, the people in Louisiana I talked to said that that never happens, but there are a lot of kind of ingrained rituals around cockfighting just to prevent that. For instance, in Venezuela, on the island of Margarita, people there are famous for using stingray poison and putting that on the blades of their cocks before a fight. Or they'll throw poison into chickens' food. Or in the Philippines, you know, I've read that sometimes handlers have been known, while the other handler is looking, they'll reach over and just snap a little bone in another cock's back, you know, tiny bone, just to cripple him a little bit. There's one famous story from the Philippines of, you know, a local mayor went to visit another district, and he went to a big cockfighting ring. And Philippines cockfighting is enormous. It's really the national sport, and it affects local politics and all this kind of thing. And the mayor went to visit another cockpit and had his own chicken, and he was fighting it, and the chicken was losing. And the mayor just jumped into the ring, pulled out his .45, and blasted the other chicken out of the ring. And people said, "What are you doing? This is cheating." He goes, "Well, no, my chicken didn't lose. He was never killed by the other chicken." And, of course, he had 10 bodyguards with him, heavily armed, and everybody said, "Well, you're right. Actually, that's new. It's a new wrinkle. I never noticed that before." So there's a lot of ways to cheat.
Now, what's the state of cockfighting in America? Where is it legal? Where is it illegal?
Well, that's just changed recently. In the fall, up until the fall, it was illegal in every state, usually a felony or a misdemeanor, except in 5 states, and those were Oklahoma, Missouri, Arizona, New Mexico, and Louisiana. But last summer into this fall, in Arizona, Missouri, a huge referendum took place where volunteers gathered over 150,000 signatures, and this fall they were made illegal in both those states. So now the only places it's legal are Oklahoma, Louisiana, and New Mexico.
I imagine that in some places it's very controversial. How do the sides typically break down?
I mean, it tends to be, I mean, it's hard to say, because the natural answer to that would be animal rights activists on the one hand and cockfighters on the other. That's kind of deceptive, because in some ways, in a place like Louisiana, for instance, you know, there are a lot of congressmen who are pro-cockfighting, who think of it as a real Louisiana tradition, and think that if you get rid of it, you're getting rid of something like the Mardi Gras. I mean, I had a friend who I met there, an academic, who said, you know, they'll sooner get rid of Little League than they'll get rid of cockfighting in Louisiana. But it tends to be animal rights activists tend to be the goads to get the laws passed. And the fact of the matter is, for the most part, if you can get a state petition that says, "Do you agree with cockfighting?" almost anyone will say no. And so that has been the best mechanism for outlawing in this country.
Yeah, so, the cockfighting is very controversial. You weren't used to going to cockfights. Give us a little bit of what the atmosphere was like in the places that you went to. I mean, is it a real, like, bloodlust type of sport?
Well, for some people it is, I'm sure. I mean, I think the atmosphere varies from the small pits to the big pits. I mean, when I went originally the first time, I went to that brush pit, Red Rooster, at midnight, and it was a thunderstorm, and I was terrified because I'd heard cockfighting always comes with drug sales and gambling and all kinds of nefarious activity, and that if you go there, you're among bad apples and all this kind of thing. So I originally was fairly frightened, and I get there, of course, and it's completely the opposite. In the small pits, the atmosphere is amazingly homey. I mean, you get there, And the night I went, it was, by the time I got there, it was about 1 a.m. And there were two mothers nursing their babies right next to that big cage. There were toddlers running up and down the aisles. There were teenagers loitering around sipping Cokes. And it was very much, you know, family night. It was like going to a PTA meeting. It was very weird. And there, I would say, most people kind of went just for that. They went because, well, this is what everybody did on a Friday night or a Saturday night, and they like to be together. I talked to a sociologist later who said that cockfighters are kind of a frozen demographic. They're like the American from the 40s or 50s still living in these little tiny pockets. You know, they tend to be rural and small town and church-going and, you know, American as apple pie. So that's the small pits. But the big pits, those are a completely different scene. I mean, I went to one where there were 900 chickens fought in one night, and there was a $40,000 purse. And, you know, people drove from hundreds of miles around. They paid $16 to sit there. And that was really a gambling scene. It was, people really didn't care about the chickens. They came with a lot of money. They wanted to see their chickens win. They wanted to leave with a lot of money. And it was also fairly, I mean, 900 chickens in a day. You can imagine there's blood everywhere. There are chickens by the end of the night. There are just broken chickens overflowing out of the trash cans, lying in the aisles. They tend to be very rickety structures because no one really trusts that cockfighting will be legal for very long. So they are these kind of claustrophobic, poorly built, you know, fire trap buildings with hundreds of people screaming out their bets. It's not a really pleasant atmosphere.
What happens to the dead or the injured chickens after a cockfight? Are the dead chickens given proper burials? Are they eaten? And what about the chickens who are just, you know, terribly wounded? Are they nursed back to health or abandoned?
There's a whole discipline of cockfight surgery which comes into play for the wounded chickens. And if you can revive a bird, you will. And if it's a bird that has shown itself to be game, it just happened to get a tendon cut or something, yeah, they'll revive it. The ones that get killed, it used to be, and in some countries this is still true, that they'd eat them. In Louisiana, they'd eat them with a sauce de brie piquante, which was special dead cockfight kind of sauce. It was very good. That doesn't happen anymore. They give them all these drugs that are carcinogenic now, so they can't. That's ended. Now they just throw them away.
My guest is journalist Burkhard Bilger. His article on cockfighting is published in this month's Harper's. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Burkhard Bilger. He's written an article on cockfighting, published in the March edition of Harper's. I don't know a lot about the history of cockfighting or about roosters in general, but, I mean, are roosters naturally as combative as this? Is there a special breed of rooster that's used for cockfighting?
At this point, there are a number of different breeds. I mean, they all descend from Gallus gallus, the jungle fowl, which comes from Southeast Asia, and those are mean birds. They're the nastiest birds in the world, some people think. The males, you know, have acres of ground that they rule as their territory, and so if another male comes onto their territory, they try to tear them apart. So, and roosters, you know, even roosters in a chicken factory or on a free range will kill each other sometimes. People call it coming into their pride. You know, there's a rainstorm or some weird atmospheric change, they'll just start hacking at each other. So chickens do have that in them. The cockfighters tend to have done a lot of genetic manipulating to increase that bloodlust. Mm-hmm. They've taken Bankiva chickens from, I think, from Southeast Asia, and Malay chickens that have all kinds of different fighting attributes, and crossbred them. They've done all kinds of genetic research. I mean, your typical cockfighter is a postdoc when it comes to chicken genetics. They know everything about alleles and crossbreeding. And then they give them drugs and they do all kinds of things just to emphasize that fighting spirit.
Cockfighting sounds so, grotesque and violent, and you write that our forefathers were cockfighters. Jefferson had game cocks. You say Andrew Jackson was fighting cocks on the White House carpet. Lincoln was a former cockfighting referee. So this whole like American history of cockfighting, huh?
I mean, cockfighting. You know, there was a time when it was called one of the most one of those fashionable amusements of American culture. It was the national pastime for a while in the 19th century. It was extremely popular. Not just those guys, but Grover Cleveland fought gamecocks. Woodrow Wilson gave plaques to cockfighters in the White House. There's even secondhand stories that Ronald Reagan, people on Ronald Reagan's ranch used to have cockfights in his ranch houses. I mean, there's this kind of, it's almost like a Thomas Pynchon novel. It's a secret history. If you start looking at cockfighting, it threads its way all through American history. But it was a mainstream amusement for most of the 18th and 19th century. And in England before that, clergymen used to stage cockfights and give prayer books as awards to the best cockfights. I mean, Henry VIII had a huge, sumptuous cockpit built with special gilded cock cages for all his lords and so forth. So it has this kind of prestigious history that got abruptly cut in this country around the beginning of the 20th century.
And what changed then?
I think two things. It kind of got attacked from two angles. One is what they call the anthropocentric angle, which is said basically that cockfighting is bad for people, that you go to a cockfight and you're with a bad element and you're engaging in bloodlust and you're emphasizing all the worst human attributes. And the other one, of course, was the rise of the Humane Society movement in the end of the 19th century, which just gradually, I mean, that was really much weaker than the former argument, but it ended up being the one that really killed cockfighting.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were interested in the ethics of cockfighting, so you spent some time at a regular chicken farm, the kind of chicken farm where chickens are born to lay eggs for our breakfast and to create chicken meat for our dinners. And compare the conditions that you found on that big chicken farm with the conditions that you found on a farm that raises chickens for cockfighting. Or roosters, I should say.
Yeah. Well, the farms where they raise cocks tend to be, I mean, by chicken terms, you know, they're like luxury resorts, which isn't to mean that, you know, that there's, you know, bronze and gilt everywhere, but every cock has his own cage, his little conical cage with a long walking strip in front of it. They have these tenders that come by and rub them down every morning and give them special feeds and exercise them. And if they get too antsy, they'll bring in these plump little pullets and have them kind of work out their desires with another chicken. It's just, it really is. If you're a chicken, you want to be a cock, a game cock, because... And they'll live much longer. They'll live 1 to 3 years in most cases. Now, you compare that to a chicken factory. I mean, I went to one in Little Rock, which is a Tyson chicken factory. And Tyson is no worse than any of the others. They have a very, very efficient chicken-raising business, and we all reap the benefits of that. I mean, chicken used to be the luxury meat in this country. It was more expensive than lobster. It was more expensive than filet mignon. When people said a chicken in every pot, it was because it was considered so outrageous that would ever come true. And it has come true, and it's come true because of the way people like Tyson raise chickens. It would take 16 weeks for a chicken to reach 2 pounds. Now it takes 6 weeks for a chicken to reach 4 pounds. I mean, genetics and nutrition and just raising methods have increased incredibly. But of course, the dark side of that is the life of the chicken. I mean, you go to a Tyson factory and there are these enormous sheds and they're just tens of thousands of chickens crammed into a shed together, shoulder to shoulder. They spend 6 weeks in there, and that's not so bad, really, because it's kind of social, at least. But that's their life. That's the best part. Then they get crammed into trucks, 7,000 at a time, carried to this factory, and dumped on this enormous conveyor belt, which is a few feet wide, which just rolls them up into the maw of this factory. And they get there, and I mean, the guy who led the tour, I'm so grateful that he even took me there, because most chicken PR people don't want you to see these factories. They just want to keep you away. But he reluctantly agreed to take me into the killing zone. And you go in there, and It's almost pitch black except for some black lights. And the workers have top 40 music screaming, and this and the machinery is incredibly loud. And the workers just pluck these chickens off this conveyor belt and reach them up very quickly and hang them by their feet from this running chain that whips by overhead very fast. And so the chickens are hanging upside down. They get whipped over into the next room. And that room is a weird room. It's lit kind of like, I mean, the one I saw was lit like a Dutch painting, you know, just a one light bulb in the corner. And the chickens come hurtling through, and they come into these mechanical bottlenecks where their heads get squeezed together and an electric shock gets jabbed into their head and they get stunned. And then as they hang limp, a rotary saw comes and slashes their head off. And you know, a few chickens will raise their heads and get away, but then somebody reaches over and cuts their throat with a knife. So it's, you know, if you had your choice between dying in a battle in a cage or dying that way, I think it'd be a fairly hard choice, but most people would probably pick the cockfight.
Burkhard Bilger's article on cockfighting is published in the March edition of Harper's. He's at work on a book about clandestine Southern traditions. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
For tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, call 877-21-FRESH. That's 877-213-7374.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. By the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And Pantheon Books, publisher of Anne Lamott's latest book, Traveling Mercies, Some Thoughts on Faith, available in bookstores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more on cockfighting and other clandestine Southern traditions with journalist Burkhard Bilger. Also, we meet John Max, a comedy writer for The Tonight Show, and Ken Tucker reviews the new CD by the Black Crowes. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with journalist Burkhard Bilger. His article about cockfighting is published in this month's edition of Harper's. The article that you wrote for Harper's on cockfighting is actually part of a larger project that you're doing. You're writing a book on clandestine Southern traditions. What do you mean by that?
I mean, I'm interested in traditions that are like cockfighting that tend to be rural and have a lot of history to them and are interesting in that sense. Is they're a rich subculture, and they tend to be outlawed or illegal. And the reason, more often than not, tends to be say a lot about our values and how they've changed in the course of, you know, American history. Another example is a thing called noodling, which I wrote a piece for The Atlantic about. And that's where you hand grab catfish with your hands. You just, in the spring, you walk along a riverbank and you stick your hand into a hole and then you wiggle your fingers. And if a catfish is in there nesting, he'll bite your hand. And so you'll jam your arm down its throat and pull up this fish on your forearm. And it's a way of catching catfish that is very old, and the Indians did it, and it's been around forever. But it's outlawed in almost every state. And the reason is people say it's unsporting. And again, it's a kind of an example. It doesn't really make any sense to say it's unsporting. It doesn't make any ecological sense. It's just kind of a judgment we pass as a culture because our values are urban and no longer rural. And so I'm interested in traditions like that that kind of put those things in perspective.
Your official paragraph-long biography says that you have a coonhound named Hattie. Is the coonhound part of your interest in these clandestine southern practices?
Oh, yeah. She's kind of she was the goad who got me into it. I think when I was living in Boston, I was kind of nostalgic for my Oklahoma roots, and I decided to buy a coonhound, which I'd always seen on country roads and so forth. So I started to look around for one. I couldn't find one. And so I made a lot of calls and finally discovered a guy who bred blue tick coonhounds in Massachusetts. And I went to visit him, and I told him that I wanted to buy a red bone coonhound. And he went, and he lifted up his hand, he said, just a second. He went in his house, and he came back with American Cooner magazine, which is just the weirdest magazine I've ever seen in my life. I mean, it's an inch thick. It has 100,000 subscribers. It's full of pictures of dogs jumping up trees and advertisements for chilled semen. You know, everybody's shipping their chilled semen all over the country. It's like, well, where did this come from? And since when is there this huge coon hunting subculture? And so I started to make calls, and I ended up writing a piece on coon hunting, and that's going to be one of the chapters in the book. And it really kind of introduced me to the interest. I mean, coon hunting is another thing. People go out in the middle of the night, every night. I mean, I hung out with a woman who coon hunts 350 nights a year. And every night at midnight, she goes into the woods, and she stays out till 5 in the morning. And most of that time, she's just standing in the forest listening to her dog run down raccoons. It's just the strangest sport in the world. And yet it's wonderful, and it's once you get into it, it's kind of addictive.
So just to clarify, me being a northern urban person, in coon hunting, the dogs track down raccoons and chase them up trees?
Yeah, I mean, professional coon hunting is a very different thing from what coon hunting used to be. I mean, there's a book called Where the Red Fern Grows, all about this kid hunting down hundreds of raccoons and killing them. And most people think that's what coon hunting is, but professional coon hunters don't kill raccoons anymore. What they do is they gather in groups of four and they go out for about 3 hours with a judge. And they just see who can chase the most raccoons up a tree in that space of time.
So now that you're deep into all these hidden southern practices, you're living in Brooklyn, New York.
Oh, yeah, the epicenter of clandestine southern traditions.
Yeah, absolutely. So I imagine there's a fair amount of cockfighting there.
There's a huge amount of cockfighting in Brooklyn. I mean, there's so many Latin and Asian immigrants. And, you know, of course, there's Santa Ria and so forth. So there's plenty of chickens around.
Are the cockfights in Brooklyn different from the southern cockfights?
I assume they are. I mean, I honestly have never been to a Brooklyn cockfight. So I don't know absolutely. From reports I've heard, they're very much like the Red Rooster cockfight, except they're more makeshift because it's illegal. There was a famous bust about 3 years ago in Harlem of a kind of a state cockfighting championship. And it was an amazing thing. They took an old theater in Harlem, and it was dilapidated, and they built all these false walls. And behind them, they had surgery rooms and drag pits, and they built a whole pit system. And the police confiscated hundreds of birds and arrested hundreds of cockfighters. So it's very active in New York.
Now, you've said that you think the reason why some of these southern traditions are disappearing, like cockfighting or noodling, is that urban values are replacing rural values. And I'd like you to explain what you mean.
I guess cockfighting, if you look at the evolution of cockfighting, that's the easiest way to see it. I mean, essentially, estates that are rural still, the most rural states, are the ones that held on the longest to cockfighting. And the ones that are the most urban most quickly saw it as just kind of an aberrant activity. I mean, to us nowadays, the idea of a cockfight in the city just, it makes no sense to us because we don't even see chickens. We have no, the notion of animals being killed, it's so distant from our thinking that it doesn't really fit in with our value system. Whereas people in the countryside, my wife, her parents grew up on a farm in Nebraska, and they had to kill chickens themselves. It's not a big deal to them. It makes sense to them that this would be part of it. So that change, more than anything, has spelled doom for some of these traditions. When I was living in California when I was a kid, when I was about 9 years old, we used to have chickens in our backyard in this little suburban house we had. And we had some young roosters, some stags, who were just born when we moved in. And they used to make the most incredible racket at night. It was amazing, just screaming at night. And a policeman came eventually and arrested them for disturbing the peace. And took them away. And to me, they always remind me a little bit of Wyatt Earp. You know, he retired eventually in L.A. in the city, and kind of was there, this gunfighter, kind of hanging out in the big city, watching his culture disappear. I think the chickens kind of reminded me a little bit of that. There were these last gunslingers in the suburban neighborhood.
Well, Burkhard, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Burkhard Bilger's article on cockfighting is published in the March edition of Harper's. He's at work on a book about clandestine Southern traditions. Coming up, writing jokes for The Tonight Show and the Academy Awards. This is Fresh Air. The Academy Awards ceremony is later this month. John Max is one of the comedy writers coming up with material for this year's host, Whoopi Goldberg. He also wrote for Billy Crystal on the last two Academy Award shows. Max writes for The Tonight Show and is the author of a new book called Heaven Talks Back, which spoofs pop inspirational books about religion. I asked him how the writing process works for the Academy Awards.
What we do is there is five or six of us, and we'd meet every day. We'd come in with what Billy would call homework. So we'd come in with 20 or 30 jokes, and Billy would sit down and read them out loud. And, you know, writing for Jay, obviously, is one thing. When you're writing for Billy, it's a different voice. So it was great because when your main, you know, job is writing for Jay Leno, you've got that voice and that comic style in your head. So when Billy would come in and read our material and put it in his voice and put his spin on it, you start to speak Billy.
Do you try to position all your best jokes toward the beginning of the broadcast? Because I imagine toward the end, jokes are getting thrown out the window because they're short on time.
He's got, besides the opening monologue and the, you know, the film clip and the songs, you know, he introduces different presenters. He's introducing different aspects of the show. He does a few things. But as you move along, people just want to get to the awards. So at hour 2.5, you're really going to find him just coming out and doing a straight introduction. But the one thing you have is what we call the playbook. And it's something that Billy had us put together and has us put together. So the fact that the show is running long is funny in and of itself. Bart the Bear last year, I don't know if you remember, but they had the great thing where they had Bart the Bear, who was, I believe, in the movie The Edge. And Bart came out and introduced an award. Well, the idea of having a giant 11-foot, you know, 4-ton bear in the middle of the stage at the Academy Awards, it, besides being kind of really neat theater, is also funny. So as a comedy writer, you're always looking for anarchy. What would have been the best thing for us? We were hoping, of course, that the bear would go nuts and not kill anyone. That would have been the funny story. So we had all these jokes written, and Billy had all these jokes, where if the bear had gone a bit wild, he was ready to deliver those jokes. Fortunately for the show, unfortunately for what we had prepared, the bear was perfect. But like one, Billy had planned to come out and just say, if the bear had gone nuts, just come out and say, I have some very sad news. It's now and Waterhouse.
Oh, so two bad things went so smoothly, huh?
Exactly that. I mean, you know, he was going to come out at one point and just say, yes, it's true. They do that in the woods. You know, and it's just we had dozens and dozens of bear jokes. You know, ladies and gentlemen, Ernest Borgnine. I mean, you had just all these great jokes that were there. And the bear was calm and did his job professionally, so we just moved on.
Before you became a comic writer, you were a political consultant. What kind of consulting did you do?
I'd started out, I'd always been interested in politics, and I started out in the late 1970s running campaigns, working my way up, and then in 1987 moved to Washington, started doing TV ads for people running for Senate and governor, did some work in the 1988 presidential race, and I worked for candidates, Governor Zell Miller of Georgia, Governor Ray Mabus of Mississippi, Senator Howard Metzenbaum, Senator Paul Simon, and ended up, actually, my closest friend is James Carville, and we worked a lot in campaigns together where he would run them, and I would end up doing the TV ads and the strategy for those campaigns.
Did you use any Tonight-style jokes in the TV ads?
People always complain about political ads and how they're all the same, and since you're shooting on a low budget, you really need to come up with something that sets it across. So, for example, in 1989... I was involved in a small way in David Dinkins' race for mayor of New York. And we came up in the primary with an ad against Ed Koch. And the ad essentially started out by just having that old song, "You Talk Too Much." And as the song played in the background and the words were in the background, we flashed up different statistics about New York City, which showed that perhaps it was time that Ed Koch moved on to a different job. And using that kind of humor, it gets people's attention. They want to listen. They're not saying, oh, this is just a political ad. And to me, that was, I think, the first genesis. The second was in 1990, Paul Simon, who was a client of mine, a good friend, was doing a gridiron speech. And he said, "Can you write some jokes for me?" I said, "Well, okay, I'll give it a try." And I wrote some material. And the next day I got a call from Frank Mankiewicz, who was a good friend of Paul's. And he said, "You know, you're funny at this. Maybe you ought to try this for a living," which I wasn't sure was the way of saying I was funny or they wanted me out of politics.
Do the political people who you write jokes for want to make it seem as if they just spontaneously have this great sense of humor and they haven't hired joke writers? Would they prefer that you not take credit for these jokes?
No one's ever said, and that's why as a general rule, I don't go out there and say, "Oh, I just wrote for Bill Clinton's, you know, gridiron speech," or whatever. If someone calls, if the president's office calls or speechwriters call or the vice president and they say, "Can you help out? Can you contribute some jokes?" I'll send them in. There's actually, I'm sure, a team of people also doing that. And I never will go out the next day and say, "Hey, hear the president's joke? That was mine. That was mine." I just kind of leave it like that because in terms of the boss, as far as I'm concerned, the boss has written all the jokes himself.
Now, how's the delivery of the political people you've written for, like Clinton, Dole, Gore?
Well, to me, I think of the non-professional comics that are out there, to me, I love Dole's delivery. I think he's, because it's very dry, it's very deadpan, he takes the right pauses. I think he really can hit a joke really well. And I've always liked seeing him when he delivers something. I wrote a few things for John F. Kennedy Jr. for a speech he gave once, and I thought he did a great job on that, too.
Now, there's something about your move that seems a little bit backwards. You went from being, I would imagine, a pretty well-compensated political consultant, moving up in the field, I would guess, maybe I'm wrong, to start at the very bottom well, I mean, you're writing for the top show, but still, you know, you're a joke writer. So did it seem like you weren't sure if you were moving up or down or what?
Well, it was a gamble in this sense. I mean, in one sense, they're saying when you're coming to The Tonight Show, you're starting off by saying, okay, you've never played baseball before, you're going to pitch in the World Series. So I was lucky enough to start out on the best show with Jay.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I was leaving a career where I was pretty well compensated and where I was established and I had clients and I had, you know, good political connections, as they say. But to me, it really was a no-brainer coming out here. I mean, I had always wanted to write comedy. Even when I was in law school, I would do a little stand-up. I was never very good, but I enjoyed doing it. I always was a fan of comedy. And when someone comes out to me and says, "Here, you've got a shot right from the start, starting on the top show on TV, you can do this," I was worth the gamble.
Give us a sense of how the monologue is written, how the writers, submit their work, how it's actually put together in a monologue.
You know, from my perspective, you know, people always get the image of comedy writers. I think all of us have the image from the Dick Van Dyke Show. You know, and you see, you know, Sally and Buddy and Dick Van Dyke sitting in the back room and Mel Cooley comes in and then Alan Brady's coming in and they're talking about it and they're fighting. But that's really writing, if you look at it, that was writing for a variety show. From the monologue perspective, it's really pretty much the writers, you know, in our rooms. You know, I sit down with my USA Today, I've got the TV on and writing down my topics and writing jokes and then turning them into Jay And Jay's taking the jokes from everyone. He's writing his own, and then he's putting it together. He and Jimmy Brogan, who's, I guess, the vice president of the monologue in the sense of Jay's friend and obviously the, you know, his top person in terms of putting together, they really put it together in a room by themselves. So I don't ever know what I've written, whether it's going to get in. A lot of times I'll hear a premise that I've submitted that's worded exactly as I've written it, but it's a totally different punchline, meaning Jay saw it, liked the idea, thought of something funnier, put it in.
What happens if a joke of yours bombs? What are some of the things that Jay Leno has said as they bombed? You know, little asides that he's made. And what would he say to you after?
He's never said anything to anyone after, ever. The great thing about The Tonight Show and The Monologue is I think we've done something like 1,550 shows. Jay's done like 1,550 shows. And it's, you know, it's in the can. You tape for the hour. It's done. It's on the air that night. You move on to the next one. And I don't think there's ever been any looking back. There's never been a, hey, John, that really didn't work or anything like that. I think he just moves on. You know, it's just because it's a topical monologue, you're always looking ahead. And I like that. It's, you know, the joke's done. That's why a lot of people say, well, what's your favorite joke? To be honest, Terry, a lot of times once they're written, I just kind of put them out of my mind because you're always working on what's new for the next day.
Does he give you any instructions at the beginning of the day of the kind of material he'd like or the kind of subjects he'd like used?
No, it's a great creative atmosphere because you just sit there and write the things that strike you as funny. And we don't write, at least from my perspective, I mean, I don't write saying, gee, I think that people will think this is funny. To me, if it makes me laugh as I'm typing it, I enjoy it. A lot of those never make the air. I write, I guess, personally about 100 jokes a day. So figure in a good day, if Jay uses one or two of mine, I'm thrilled.
That's a lot of jokes.
It's a lot of rejection.
Yeah.
Rejected 98 on a good day. I'm rejected 98% of the time.
So where do all the dead jokes go?
Recycling.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember any of them? Do you test them out on your? Do you go home at night and say, "Hey, this is the one Jay didn't like, but it's funny, isn't it? Laugh, come on, laugh, it's funny."
No, I really tend to look forward. It's when I say it goes into recycling. Once it's done, it's not used. It's in the trash can. I mean, the concept may stay with me a little bit. I might try it a slightly different spin next time. But it's like, you know, okay, today, you know, or this week right now, I'm reading that, you know, the movie's out today, like. Monday every day you come out with what movies there are. So what are the top movies of the week? Well, it's Payback, and it's 8mm, and it's Message in a Bottle. So it's, gee, can I come up with something funny with any of those movies? And if it doesn't work, well, there's going to be a new number one movie next week.
Well, John Max, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
John Max writes for The Tonight Show and is the author of the new book Heaven Talks Back, a spoof of pop books about religion. Coming up, a new CD by the Black Crowes. This is Fresh Air. The Black Crowes have been around for a decade now, American Southerners stubbornly playing a guitar-based rock and roll heavily influenced by British rock, specifically the mid-70s period Rolling Stones. The Black Crowes' new album, their fifth, is called By Your Side, and rock critic Ken Tucker says the Crowes' throwback tendencies have rarely sounded better.
My favorite description of the Black Crowes is one given to them by the British pop music magazine Melody Maker a few years ago. They called the Crowes the world's most rock and roll band. The idea is essentially a reactionary one, that real rock and roll is the stuff that's played with a couple of guitars and some slamming drums by rowdy white guys. Even if that notion has become hopelessly limiting, the Crowes can find ways to use it to make gut-punchingly effective rock. Excuse me, rock and roll. The Black Crowes from Atlanta, Georgia, are led by the Robinson brothers, singer Chris and lead guitarist Rich. They're classic rock and roll goofballs, always fighting with each other, kicking out members of the band, they have a new bassist for this CD, and showing an ornery streak. In 1991, they got booted off a ZZ Top tour sponsored by Miller Beer for making sarcastic remarks on stage about commercialism. Somehow, even when the group is ripping off the Rolling Stones' Tumblin' Dice, as they do to commence the song By Your Side, the Crowes still manage to invest the music with enough of their own personality to give it its own unique kick. At their most standard, the Black Crowes are just a very good boogie band. At their best, they connect not only with their British fetishes, but also with their southern roots to produce funky cuts like Diamond Ring.
Come on, baby, say my name. Well, do you want to play a game? It feels so good, it's almost pain.
The Black Crowes haven't had a hit in a few years, and at a time when the charts are dominated by hip-hop and pure pop, they seem more marginalized than ever. Perhaps they feel this marginalization, and it accounts for the renewed vigor of their musical conservatism, manifested as a tradition-bound music that refuses to recognize any boundaries at all.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed the Black Crowes' new album, By Your Side. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet. with Alan Tu, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Kathy Wolf, and Tracy Tannenbaum. Research assistance from Sam Adams. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, call 877-21-FRESH. That's 877-213-7374. Fresh Air is also available online at audible.com/freshair.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Bantam Books, publisher of Daniel Goleman's companion volumes, Emotional Intelligence and Working with Emotional Intelligence, available nationwide. And from Turner Classic Movies, presenting 31 Days of Oscar during the month of March. Tonight, Burt Lancaster, Montgomery Clift, and Frank Sinatra star in From Here to Eternity. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This year marks the centenary of Alfred Hitchcock's birth. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Evan Hunter, who wrote the screenplay for Hitchcock's The Birds, and actress Janet Leigh, the star of Psycho. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.